G'day, it's Daniel Harford. Welcome to the Best of the Breakfast Club on RSN 927. It was jam-packed. Check it out.
Good morning, Whitey.
Morning, Harf. Lots of very interesting things to talk about this morning.
Lots to get through on a Monday morning, let alone all the motorsport across the weekend. We've got a new coach, the Australian Diamonds, we need to talk about as
well.
Yes. Super Netball weekend. There's poor old Magpies in Super Netball. Don't know what's going on there. We need to get Rob Wright on at some stage. And sit him down with Adam Ramanauskas, who's a premiership player with the Bombers, of course, and these days manager to the Stars, a very important team member of the Breakfast Club team. Rammer, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. We're in that funny month, Jaloom. It's an interesting month, that one.
I saw you turn your head when I said that you did.
Yeah. It's a bit like the days of the week at the moment. There's no Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. It's just day now. Day
it's
after
true.
Day. And that really, it's right in the middle of the year, Jaloom, isn't it? Just right in the middle of things.
As soon as I said it, I knew you'd be coming for me. As soon as I said it. That's what happens when you're reading things and thinking things at the same time.
It was a big weekend, wasn't it, in sport. There's plenty going on. Obviously, like you said, the motorsport, the NBA was back, the baseball was back, the netball, the football. It's starting to feel half normal again, I think, with sport on the calendar for a weekend. The tour started, which I watched a bit last night, so it was fantastic. It was good. It was good that there was something to watch all weekend.
Yeah, there was. The A-League Grand Final, unfortunately.
Yes, I watched that as well.
The other thing?
Yeah, unfortunately, from a Melbourne perspective, Melbourne City couldn't quite get over the line. Went to extra time before there was a goal scored in the first half of extra time from Sydney FC to get them over the line. But it did look particularly early on that Melbourne City were going to win that game. Which would have been an amazing, amazing story considering where they've come from over the last couple of years. But and it was great to see them also, guys, wear the red and white of Melbourne Heart as the away strip. Now, obviously, they wear light blue like Sydney FC, so they had to wear an alternate strip. But it was sort of, I think it was quite appropriate that they did that considering their background. But unfortunately, they couldn't get over the line either. So, yeah, lots was going on. Where do you want to start, Daniel?
Well, now you tell me about this US Open story.
Well, it's developing as we speak, but a player has tested positive to COVID-19. Now, the player is asymptomatic. The player hasn't been announced officially, but it is a male player. And it's just going to be really interesting to see how it plays out. Now, the tournament is to start tomorrow our time, and we'll obviously speak to Darren Kaler a little bit later on, but they're now sort of contact tracing this particular player to make sure that other players test as well. So I'm not really sure how it plays out, but they're all in this New York bubble. They were able to play a tournament last week, and that seems to have gone through without any issues. But now on the doorstep of the first major since the Australian Open, we've got this situation where I'm not sure. They're confident they'll play, but I'm not sure how it plays out over the next, even just the next couple of hours.
Right. Okay. Did we talk about that on? Did we talk about that Friday with someone? What happens if someone tests positive? No,
it wasn't Friday.
Conversation I had with somebody else through the weekend. It might have been that one. Because it's always the danger, I suppose. Why? Because they practice with each other. They're in the locker rooms.
Yep.
Oh, goodness. Well, I'm sure they're social distancing and all these things, but still.
Well, I'm not sure how it all works. So Darren Kaler should be able to help us because he's actually over there commentating for US television. Now, his player, Simona Halep, that he looks after, decided not to go. But how it all works out with this, buddy system or, so they can practice and they've got, they want a coach, they want a physio, all these sorts of things, sharing gyms in this bubble. Obviously, from an NBA basketball point of view, it's worked extremely well with the bubble setup. obviously AFL football has worked extremely well to this point with the bubble situation. So, I think it's going to be a fascinating story over the next couple of hours because tennis has had its problems. Obviously, the Novak Djokovic tournament in Europe caused all sorts of problems. There's also political issues going on that the players have set up their new association and Novak Djokovic is right in the thick of that. Roger Federer has had a bit of a crack at Novak Djokovic. It's all happening in the world of tennis without it actually happening yet.
We should make reference to the Friday face-off, which, of course, is a very important part of the program. Now, Trevor Nelson from Mount Waverley was the winner of the Friday face-off last Friday. Well done to you, Trev. You've won a $100 voucher for Ribera's at Swallows, where they offer simply the freshest and best seafood available, 192 Station Street in Port Melbourne. Because Trevor correctly identified that I'm a genius. And, of course, I picked Patrick Dangerfield to be the contested possession champion on Friday night in Geelong's amazing comeback against the Western Bulldogs and extend my lead in the Friday face-off tournament, which is clearly just, I'm just shelling peas at the moment in the Friday face-off. So if you haven't registered for the face-off, you can still get involved. A few games still to go. rsn.net.au, and I would select me if you wanted to have any chance of winning the Friday face-off. But well done to Trev. Great stuff indeed. Just on the A-League Grand Final, it was extra time, Rammer. Extra time for the A-League Grand Final. There was the VAR controversy, which was always going to happen at some stage, where Melbourne City were robbed of a goal early in proceedings. And in the end, that was effectively the only real good look that they had through the night. Although they played well, Melbourne City. Sydney FC's 100th minute stunner was enough to get them the chocolates.
Well, it was a stunner. It was a chest. It was the use of the chest by Joe Dirt, really, Ryan Grant.
That's Joe Dirt.
That's what he looked like with the haircut, and he had plenty going on. So it wasn't your typical sort of a soccer player. Usually they're perfectly manicured. So Ryan just had the mullet going, a bit of a short little top, and real shaved on the sides. And he came from nowhere. And
it's a beautiful
Well, it's beautiful ball. Usually you see with the feet or the head, but he's chested it in past the keeper. So it was amazing.
As Andy Harper said, he chested it in with his nipple.
Yes. Yeah, correct.
He nippled it in, he said.
That's right. He did say nipple. It was a good reference.
The VAR, why was that goal disallowed?
I'm still trying to work that out.
Yeah.
I'm still trying to work that out.
It was very tricky to work out why. Now, I think because the last City player was offside, but he had absolutely no influence on that shot at goal. Now, unless he was in the way of the goalkeeper, I still can't quite work out why that goal was not allowed.
No, I'm with you on that. I can't quite work it out. And there was great controversy with that, as it was always going to be. VAR's become one of the most talked about things in sport. The goal review technology.
Sydney FC now, that's their fifth championship, or fifth title, let's call it. They're a good soccer club.
Three of the last four, they've been back-to-back winners. They are a fantastic team in the A-League. And we should congratulate them. We didn't do that before. We can congratulate Sydney FC for a dominant season. Let's be honest, they were the dominant team all year. They won the Premier's Plate, now the Champions Plate as well. They were the best, and Julie found a way to get the chocolates in the biggest moment of all last night in the grand final. Three of the last four for Sydney FC, and I think 9 of 15 between Victory and Sydney FC. So I think that there is now, not that there wasn't before last night, concern about the opportunities for clubs outside of those big two to really contend. We know Perth have had their moment in the sun a couple of times as well. But can everyone really expect to be a chance in the A-League is one of the conversations that now is coming along, which is probably valid to a point. It doesn't make much sense if there's a salary cap and that type of thing that one or two clubs are so much stronger than the others. Not as if there's hundreds of millions of dollars going into those clubs like the EPL, where you've got some financial backer who's just buying great players. It might start to be a concern for the A-League if that continues.
Well, interestingly about that half is that with the potential, the mooted changes with the A-League, it was actually going to make it even more difficult to win for teams outside the obvious with salary cap changes and all sorts of things that they were looking at. But Melbourne, Sydney FC, in a lot of ways, were a little bit like Richmond there for a while, where they were the sort of non-winners, that they'd always seen as being a good team that could never get it done when it mattered most, or rarely get it done when it mattered most, despite the dominance through, you know, large portions of seasons. And now, you know, they virtually win everything. So, but they did have that title there for a while as a bit of a sort of a, you know, an almost sort of team. But that's obviously changed in recent years.
We should give a bit of love to Jamie Wincup across the weekend as well in terms of the world of sport, because up at the Townsville Super Sprint, he was able to win two of the three races, races 19 and 20 in the Supercar Championship, and close the gap in the championship for the Supercar. I think it's down to 123 points now, the gap. It is from Scotty McLaughlin, who took out race 21. Up there in Townsville, well, sixth and seventh in the races that Jamie Wincup won, so he lost some points there to Jamie, but he did come back and win race 21, so 123 points. And a big announcement across the weekend for the Supercars that Bathurst will be the championship decider for the first time, which will be fantastic, all on the line at the Mountain.
Yeah, that's good. Terrific that's happened.
That's
good. Scotty McLaughlin had all sorts of problems earlier in the weekend with cars hitting him and other, you know, strategic issues that he'd had. So he actually fought back extremely well to win. But I think it's set up fantastically well for the sport that we're going to get to Mount Panorama with it all on the line. That's kind of what you want in what's obviously been such a compromised season for the Supercars, that at least something pretty significant is to drive for in that final weekend.
Yep. And no, that's good business.
Staying on motorsport, half, you would have watched the F1s with your daughter last night?
Saw a bit of the action last night. Lewis took out the Spanish Grand Prix. Valtteri Bottas in second place. Max Verstappen in third. Belgium. Now, boy, Daniel Ricciardo did a good job finishing in fourth there at the Spanish Grand Prix. We saw, you know what, I didn't see all of it, Ram, I must admit. I saw a bit of it and I went to bed. Because I knew Lewis was going to go well again.
It would have been taped, though, to watch sort of prime time tonight, I would have thought, by the fans.
We watch things live. We watch things live here in the Harford household. But there was a bit of action. Remy, you're right. The F1 thing is becoming a thing. And I like it.
So it's intensifying in the family, is it? It hasn't gone away.
No, it's not intensifying. It's just, it is what it is. It's just there. We watch. We watch the F1s.
Right.
It's a lovely father-daughter thing to do.
Did you get to the bottom of why?
I can't remember. I think there was a conversation at one stage about some of her friends were into it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And we concluded that it was...
And you concluded that there was a...
Quotation marks, friends...
You concluded that it was a male friend that was the instigator of
male
the interest.
Variety, yes.
My understanding, there was a male friend that was part of it, but there was also some female friends that were part of it too. So there's no romanticism. There's no romance, my understanding is.
It must be a real dominant male in that friendship group.
Yes,
that's,
exactly.
That's an aficionado of motorsport.
Don't think that my daughter can't like sports that traditionally you sexist chauvinist pigs might think are just male appreciation sports only. We know Nikki off the SMS will be listening, and
she is a
lover of the F1. Don't go dragging my daughter into your chauvinistic pig world. Right?
The way you described it a few weeks ago was all of a sudden I walk in and my daughter's watching the F1s for the first time ever.
Wow!
So we can only conclude from that
sports. That's right. Motorsport's something that is in the family or not in the family. It's not something that just dramatically overnight becomes a thing.
It's
something that's nurtured over time.
You know that I'm a lover. I watch the bikes, I watch the cars, I watch the F1s. You know that I'm into it. So maybe it's just rubbed off. Maybe she just found an appreciation for excellent broadcast of sport, because they do it better than anyone, motorsport. They broadcast sport better than any other sport on the planet. They are brilliant. Because you learn. In fact, the other sport, which is almost as good, and we're going to talk about after the break, because cycling, the way they cover cycling, particularly the Grand Tours, and the information you get from the commentary teams, that is almost as good as the F1 stuff.
Wow. Yeah, but that the with the Grand Tours, that's like an advertisement with wherever they are for tourism for that part of the world. Really, you're finding out about all the chateaus and the castles and all sorts of things when you're watching the tour. So a lot of it, they don't even talk about the cycling for 2/3 of it.
No, they do. They do talk about team tactics and what's happening and how they're doing all this. I love it.
Who's the one that's going back to get to the car to get the Mars bars and all that sort of stuff? And then they have to bring them all up, their little food bags. And what are they called? The Domestique or whatever they're called.
The Domestique, one of the great titles in sport. Who are you? I'm the Domestique. Don't pretend that you don't love that.
What was the... A few years back, they used to have the chef at the start of the Tour de France. He used to cook before the race started.
Yes.
That killed me, 20 minutes.
No, there's another. They've got a new guy in, Guilherme. I saw that the other day. There's a new introduction of a new chef to help Gabrielle out.
We don't need
fantastic
that.
Stuff. The foods of the France. It's fantastic. Fantastique. Domestique. All these words. Fantastic. Enigmatique.
350 metres to go. Here comes the peloton led by Luis Leon Sanchez.
The Spanish champion is chasing. Yates is leading out. Alaphilippe is waiting. Hirschi is playing with a cold head and a warm heart. It's Yates who leads. Alaphilippe, the peloton breathing down their neck. They could be caught.
Van Avermaet goes.
So too does Alaphilippe. Hirschi responds. Yates tries to stick with him. Alaphilippe, he does it again. It's Alaphilippe who was bold. He holds on surely. Hirschi, Alaphilippe, just.
The final stages of stage two of Le Tour started across the weekend. A lot of people having some late nights for the next little while, watching it all unfold on our timeline. But Julian Alaphilippe won stage two in a sprint finish to claim the yellow jersey in Nice. Held off Mark Hirschi to edge home by half a wheel after leaving Britain's Adam Yates behind in a final dart for the line. Now, that's important, Adam Yates' position, because he's part of our team at Mitchelton Scott, and he is now sitting second in Le Tour, just 4 seconds behind Julian Alaphilippe. And Matt White's the sporting director at Mitchelton Scott, who I'm sure is very pleased about that. He joins us on The Breakfast Club. Good morning, Matt.
Yeah, good morning, guys. How's things?
We are going very well, thank you. How's things over there for you guys in Nice at the moment?
Yeah, look, I'd be lying if I thought it feels like a normal Tour de France with everything going on around us, but it's good to get the racing up and away in the middle of a pandemic, and the boys have certainly responded well, and it's a nice start for us to get some runs on the board and move into second place overall.
Yeah, which is fantastic with Adam Yates there. What are you expecting from Adam through this? We've got Esteban Chavez, who's my man, who's 17 seconds back at this stage. Obviously, very early doors in the Tour. Don't get too excited too early. But what were your expectations coming in for this edition of the Tour?
Look, we're looking to win some stages here. Look, Adam Yates was the plan at the start of the year, and the plan right through had been he would probably lead our team general classification-wise. And then he got sick about 6 weeks ago and missed a couple of weeks training. Now, look, it might sound funny seeing his results now, but he missed a key period of training. And we are not riding general classification with him, but we are definitely looking to win stages. And the plan is to hit it early in his first week, maybe back off a little bit in the second week and go again in a very, very tough back end of the race for the climbers. And look, Esteban's in a good place as well. So, look, it's not a normal start to the Tour de France. Yeah, that was a mountain stage today on day two. And this first 9 days right across to the Pyrenees, it's a very tough one and not your typical start to the Tour.
In terms of the overall Tour and the field, normally in the last decade or so, we've come into the Tour with knowing that there's really one or two chances to take it out. We've had some dominant performers in the last little while, probably 20 years, really. Well, what about this year's edition? Is it that clear-cut, or is it a bit more open this year, considering some of the challenges that the field's going through just to get the race going anyway?
So I think going into the tour, the two favourites is probably last year's winner, Egan Bernal from Colombia on Ineos, and then Primoz Roglic, who won the Vuelta a España last year and who's won most races that he started in the last 12 months. They're the two clear favourites coming in, but the big difference this year is none of the athletes have had the same preparation or a normal preparation race-wise. Some guys have been locked in their houses for 10 weeks, not been able to train outside. Some guys have had perfect preparation. Some countries haven't locked down at all. So it really is going to be a different Tour de France. And also, you know, the Tour de France is normally July, not September. Yeah. So there's a lot of different variabilities this year to the Tour. But at the end of the day, there's no need for excuses. And we're all in the same boat on once the race starts. And it could throw up some surprises.
So, Matt, as sporting director, are you doing anything differently? Sort of give us a bit of an insight to our listeners about some of the protocols that you have to adhere to with, obviously, under the, as you said before, the cloak of COVID.
Yeah, so my residence is in Spain. So Spain and Italy had the two harshest lockdowns here in Europe. So one thing that's become quite normal is face masks. So and here now in France, so the only time that we're allowed to not have a face mask on is when you're in the confines of your own room or when you're at meal times. So we're wearing masks for a big chunk of the day. As far as the testing, all the races that we go to, we're getting testing 6 days out and 3 days out from an event. So I think I've had 7 or 8 COVID tests in the last 6 weeks. And then obviously there's a lot of protocols, which, cycling in general, a sport that is on the move a lot at our races. In this month, we're staying at 18 hotels in 25 days. Just the general sanitisation of the hotel rooms. A big emphasis on hand hygiene. And obviously, we are doing things like all the riders have their own rooms. The vast majority of staff have their own rooms. When we're at dinner time, eating a metre apart, just little things that limit the mitigate the risks.
And did you think that this would happen? I mean, obviously, it's happening, as you said, in September and not in July. But just with everything that's gone on, do you sort of have time to reflect back and think, we're actually doing this?
I think if you'd asked me in the middle of April, when there was 1,000 people dying a day in Spain, whether we'd be racing a Tour de France this year, I wouldn't have had the same opinion as I have now. It's amazing we've been able to get this far, really. And the Tour de France is the biggest annual sporting event on the planet. And look, we're 2 days in. We've still got 18 days to go, 19 days to go. But it's been a hell of a lot of organisation and logistical challenges from all the teams involved, and obviously our world body, and the big one is the French government to stage an event of this magnitude with the number one priority is the health of the public and the health of the athletes.
We love a bit of magic from Jimmy, and he's back again with us on a Monday morning. Good morning, Jim.
Morning, gentlemen. How are we?
We're going great. How's your world?
It's not bad. Not bad. I think we've Geelong and Richmond are, I think, franked their premiership contentions over the weekend. And I think your form ladder is just looking brilliant. Half with a narrow, nail-biting win for the Demons over the Saints.
We tip this, Jim.
This is good for your form ladder. It's good for your form ladder.
Why do you go down this path to start with the form ladder? Now we'll talk about it for the next hour, Jim.
Because the key here, Rammer, you've got to get the driver on side. So, when you're doing a long road trip, did many a long road trips as a kid up and down the Hume Highway, if you get the driver on side, you might get a sneaky stop somewhere here.
Yeah.
A little roadhouse for an extra snack.
Your chance for a Chucky Thick Shack somewhere along the line, Jim, this sort of stuff keeps up. Yeah, exactly. Sneaky cheeseburger and Chucky Thick Shack. Spot on. Spot on. We'll get to the form later because it's an important part of the story in 2020, as everyone out there in football land knows. They're all talking about it. Don't pretend they're not, Rammer. I don't know why you're dismissing it so cleanly there.
I haven't heard it mentioned once in the last 2 weeks.
Rama, one thing that I've noticed over the last period of time is how difficult it is to be a Melbourne supporter. I've heard about it. I've heard about the agony they go through, the stress, the dislike for their own team, despite supporting them. Jeez, they're hard to follow. Oh, gosh.
Well, let's start there. While we're talking about the Bees and the form ladder, because it was a very, very important game for both teams. In fact, a couple of games across the weekend, Jim, were important for both teams. There's a bit on the line for a couple of games. A couple of one-sided affairs, which didn't mean too much, but there was a couple that really did have some weighting behind it. This was certainly one of those. It was Alice Springs on Saturday night, TIO Traeger Park. And it was we had a brief conversation about it yesterday, Jim. I think it was a win for the coach's box of the Demons in that game against St Kilda, because on paper and on form, as we discussed Friday on the Friday footy preview, you would have thought St Kilda should win that game, but Melbourne found a way to stop St Kilda, particularly in that first half, outside of the last 3 minutes of the second quarter, particularly in that first half. The coach's box battle, or the plan in place by Melbourne, was a very, very good one.
Yeah, and I agree with you wholeheartedly, Half, and I've heard you speak about this, and you got to tip your cap to the coaching staffs when they do well, because, geez, when they don't, they come under all sorts of pressure, don't they? They threaten with getting sacked by the general public and the media alike. But I agree with you. They stopped St Kilda's run and dash from half-back, that flowing 100-metre plays, 150-metre plays from half-back where you create the overlap. And then you think of Membry and these sort of guys working inside forward 50, almost being able to back lead, side lead, having all that space. But Melbourne were able to stop that. And the amount of times during the game where you saw the Saints actually win possession, but then go back slow off the mark. Now, it's one thing to have the plan, but then you have to execute it. I think in the first sort of three quarters, still it was anyone's game. It was like both sides had beautifully set up walls across half back, and the game was just like that the old Brickell game, doot, 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 like, you know, just going back and forth from the two half back lines. But I think what Melbourne did a bit better than St Kilda is their pressure on the ball carrier and the kicker, which allowed Stephen May to have such an impact he did. Now, he played on a young key forward, but you need pressure on the ball carrier as well. Like, we didn't see too many Saints players coming through the middle and having a lot of time and space to find those players in that launch zone from 70 metres out forward, Rama.
In the end, that was the difference. I thought Stephen May, albeit Petrarca, 20 possessions, four goals. Stephen May, I think he had 12 intercept possessions for the game. Mm. Max King couldn't at least even halve those contests. That was the issue, where he couldn't then allow St Kilda's smalls to come to life in that forward half of the ground. So Stephen May would mark or take the ball away, and it'll just go back the other way. Whereas St Kilda in the past, you talk about that speed, Jim, that they've had from half back, but they've also been manic inside their forward half, where they didn't have that opportunity really to own territory too much. When a player is so dominant, and we saw that a couple of weeks ago with Jeremy McGovern over in West Coast with his intercept marking and possessions, it becomes really, really difficult for your small forwards to be involved in the game.
One change, and I know it wouldn't have been, probably wouldn't even change the effect, but I would have liked to see is someone like I know Nick Hind, I know he's not a big possession getter, but at least try him at half back. So, with the instruction, if we intercept the footy, can you loop around the back, or can you be that handball receiver? Because he's so quick over the first 10 metres, he can shorten that defence. So, look, you want to try and catch out where you're kicking the ball over Stephen May and Max King's head. So you'd say to King and May that matchup, can you play a lot higher? And then you try and carry the ball and get them really short, and then you get your better matchup deep inside forward 50. Does that make sense, how I'm explaining that?
Yep.
Yeah, and I think that what you're saying there from a security perspective was the way that Melbourne defended that, Jim, was the reason why they struggled. Because normally teams would press up. If the Saints are coming out from half-back, they'd press up and try and restrict them into their defensive half. But Melbourne said, you can have that free player back there. That's fine. We're just going to stand still, and you're going to have to get past us. And that took away that ability to leapfrog and overlap, handball and run and carry. It was actually really, really clever. in the first half. Now, because then when they got possession back, the D's, they took all the energy out of the game. It was kick mark. Secured to want the game in flow. They want a transition goal. I think three of their first half goals out of the four they kicked were transition goals. Melbourne kicked four of the first five half goals is from stoppage goals. So that wasn't sustainable. So they took the speed out of the game and didn't allow St Kilda what they wanted, which was a bit of chaos, a bit of manic play, which is more their bread and butter this year. So I thought it was a bloody good plan. In the end, in the second half of the game, Ram, it was just more of a war of attrition because it was difficult conditions for the players to get through. It was just an arm wrestle to see who can hang on the longest in the end.
And I do understand what Whitey's talking about earlier, being a Melbourne supporter, because it looked like the most likely in that last quarter was going to be St Kilda. Inside 50s ended up 30-46 in St Kilda's favour, and that's what I talk about with Stephen May, how he played that game. Tactically, yep, what you're saying, Half, is, and Jim, is absolutely spot on, but he was just a wall there, Whitey.
Yeah, we'll talk to Max Gawn about this tomorrow, but it seemed that Melbourne was so fixated with what they were doing to stop St Kilda playing it the way it wanted to, that at times they forgot that they had to score themselves. So it was really just a case of trying to hold on in that last quarter. But the ramifications on this game are fascinating. If you look at the top eight at the moment, seven of the eight teams in the top eight have lost only, or you've got it in front of you, Half, but seven of the top eight teams have only lost one of their last five games.
Right. Seven of the top eight teams have lost one of their last five games.
Yep, or in the case of Geelong, have won all of their last five. But St Kilda sticks out that they've actually lost three of their last four, but three of their last five. So when we talk about a form ladder, Half, that you mentioned, St Kilda's the vulnerable one just based on their form. And I guess the question I've got for you guys is it a case of St Kilda needing a break because they've got the break this round? They don't play until next week and they're getting a bit tired because they've done a lot of work in their fixture, having to travel to Adelaide on consecutive times and all that sort of thing from Queensland, you know, where they're staying. Or is it a case that people have kind of worked them out as to how to play and have taken away their strength?
I think, Jim, it just gives you a bit of a chance to tweak the things that, you know, that you're worrying about. Like, because teams aren't having that time during the week where they really get out there and are able to really to practice some sort of part of their game that they need to improve quickly. With a little break now for the Saints, they can go back, have a look at things closely, okay, go out and train a few things differently, and you might just see some subtle changes, Jim, in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, and you can do a bit of that structural training that you're talking about there, Rammer. And most importantly, and you heard Brett Ratton in the press conference afterwards when they asked him about the goal line review. He goes, well, we've got other issues because when you've got three players behind the ball and Petrarca gets the ball in the middle of them, now, brilliant play from Petrarca. Let's not overlook that. But one of the three should at least come over and intercept the footy or kill it wide to a boundary. And then at worst, yeah, the ball, not have the ball just drop at Petrarca's feet so he can spin around and tackle it. Everything that you didn't want to happen, they did in that situation. And then you can work on that ball movement stuff. And it's a bit about Melbourne as well. Oliver obviously leading possession, get it with 26. But it's all defenders or mids who play back in the next 10. So Langdon, who gets a long way back on the wing, is next. But it's May, Salem, Hibbard, Rivers are your next possession getters. It's inviting the opposition at you. Now, another side might capitalise, and Melbourne's got to make that decision how far they sit back and defend, because we've seen the modern game is defenders defending higher for forward half intercepts. But Melbourne certainly played to their strengths, which was their half back line and their backs, who are very good at winning the footy. So I think for both, it's where they go from this game. Does Melbourne double down on this system, which is you're inviting the pressure, and other sides, the top sides like Port Adelaide, Geelong, Richmond, West Coast could probably expose that sort of defence. And for the Saints, how do you work your way through when sides try and slow you down from half-back?
So for the Saints, they've got the bye this week, as Whitey said. Then they've got Hawthorn, West Coast and the Giants to finish.
They need to win two of those three halves. St Kilda need to win two of their last three. Yeah, the Giants beating Fremantle was a bad result for St Kilda. That wasn't too, and even Collingwood winning wasn't a great result for St Kilda either, because it just puts them in this this wash of teams now. And they've played 14. So they're in 7th and they've played 14. But if you look below them, Melbourne have only played 13. The Giants have only played 13. The Bulldogs 14. Played 14. And then Essendon and Carlton have only played 13. So on the ladder, they look relatively safe, St Kilda, because they're a game inside with a fairly good percentage, but they can be eaten up fairly quickly without playing with the Demons, the Giants, and I mean, I'm not sure whether you can throw Essendon in, to be honest, but if you do throw Essendon in, they're all teams that have got a game less or played a game less at this point.
I wouldn't think you'd throw Essendon in. Melbourne, by the way, have got
I wouldn't have either.
Sydney,
I wouldn't either.
Fremantle, the Giants, and Essendon on the way home. So they're very, very winnable games that if you're half a decent team, you should be winning at least half of those, possibly three.
Yeah, but I think half Melbourne needs to rely on some results going their way.
I'm not so sure.
I know we've got Collingwood Carlton shortly half, but who's Collingwood got on the way home?
Collingwood have got Brisbane this week, and then they've got the bye, and Gold Coast and Port Adelaide. So tough. Brisbane and Port Adelaide's tough. Gold Coast were very good yesterday, which we'll get to at some stage. But
that Carlton game season.
So important. Yeah, exactly.
So, 6, 7, 8 are not by no means locked in yet on that ladder.
No, they're not. They're not. But that's what I'm saying with teams like Melbourne and the Giants. They're still going to have to rely on, I think, results going their way because they play each other. So, you know, it'd be very handy if Collingwood, you know, didn't win. I mean, I'm only stating the obvious, but they can't. They're not quite in that situation where they control their own destiny because of who everybody else plays. Which goes to Jimmy's point: when you play each other once, this is what's created a much more even season.
I think the Magpies only need one more win. I reckon 9.5 will get them in.
One.
Yep.
Nine and a half will get them in.
The draw will be the key.
Yeah.
9.5 will get them in. So they've got to beat the Gold Coast, I reckon. That's the game they could set themselves for. After the bye, they can freshen up and go hard in round 17 against the Gold Coast. Let's have a chat about the Pies and the Blues yesterday, Whitey. I know you were angling towards it early in the show this morning.
Yeah.
Jim, you were covering for Channel 7 yesterday. Mm-hmm. Whitey, I'll let you take it away.
Yeah, I was really keen to talk to Jimmy about this because Carlton had a lead at halftime and were playing the better footy in the first half. And then they had a period of play for about, I reckon, 10, maybe even 12 minutes in that third term where they completely dominated play and they couldn't put it on the scoreboard. They had plenty of inside 50s. They had plenty of situations where they were forward of centre under little pressure and the skill execution wasn't there. It looked to me of a team that realised, geez, our season's on the line here and we could win this. And they kind of froze under that pressure of finishing off. It was like a young tennis player coming through that had the break of serve and was trying to serve out the set, and they just couldn't do it. And in the end, they allowed Collingwood back into the contest, and away Collingwood went, who kind of knows how to win because of the experience they've got at doing it. What were your thoughts on that?
I think that's really fair, Whitey, and I think I've mentioned this about Carlton throughout the year when they've had some losses, is they're doing this transition from being a poor side for quite some time to being a good side and where they are on the ladder. And it looked a bit of that maturity and, I guess, game knowledge and awareness, which David Teague's done a really good job in fast-tracking as much as possible because they've had some good wins. But you see in their losses, they're all... you go to the Port Adelaide loss there at the Gabba. It was just all decision-making, where we need to go, where we need to be with the ball, game awareness, game situation sort of stuff. And when Carlton were on top and winning the footy, as you mentioned, that third quarter, it was the selection coming inside forward 50. And we've spoken about, even just referring to Melbourne just before, sides in that part of the ladder, what they don't do well is that last kick inside forward 50. Now, what separates just the average sides to the top sides is that decision-making forward to centre, when to go long, then when to hit the one coming up short, but it's also the type of kicks. Now, early in the game, Carlton missed a massive opportunity even in the first quarter when they had plenty of free ball, but they just dumped it. You know, when you've got so many tools, you've still got to kick it to their advantage to give them an opportunity. Collingwood were the same. Collingwood had five blokes over 500 centimetres tall yesterday. They're the world's biggest side. But it wasn't until the second half where they actually started to kick it a little bit flatter into Mason Cox forward of the footy that he was actually able to take some sort of advantage of his height. I think people, when they see the guy the size of a tree, they kick it right up a chimney. Now, that just plays into the defence's hand. They just all start peeling off. You become predictable. But Carlton, they just to work out that balance of when you hit up the lead to when you take long the contest. That's just how I saw it, Rammer. I just saw it more as an execution. And I think a side going from making that transition from a poor side to the good side, they're going to have that fluctuation throughout games.
Yeah, and it's almost, it's those, I guess, heartbreakers that you have to go through as a team to become good. It's how you come out the other side of those heartbreakers. Now, I want to see them really bounce back next week, the Blues. But look, you look at the last quarter in isolation, the half, seven of the top 10 possession winners were all Collingwood players. Yeah. You know, their ability to control the tempo and flow of the game in that last quarter was really, really important. Carlton really couldn't get on top around that contest. They couldn't get that territory battle, which Collingwood won, like in that last quarter particularly, where the ball seemed in their forward half of the ground. I was waiting in that last quarter for Collingwood to take over, and they eventually did take over. I know it took them to, you know, the final couple of minutes, but I didn't feel like Carlton were the team that were pushing hard enough to win that last quarter. Collingwood looked more dangerous at ground level. Jim mentioned those taller type players. Well, you know, Cox, Mychek started to get on top, but then you look inside forward 50. Tyler Brown had a good game. Stevenson looked like he's back to some sort of form. Dacos kicks the sealer. Thomas, you know, those guys at ground level, when the ball was on the ground wide, he was, you know, that was, I felt the difference in that last quarter.
Yeah, they had the game breakers. And I think the great thing for Collingwood is that Josh Dacos now falls into that category. He's elevated his game, and he's, it's not just the skills, it's when he's executing. He kicked the winning goal against Sydney. Mm. He kicks a really important goal against Carlton. And the interesting thing about Collingwood is that it's 2 weeks in a row now they've played pretty ordinary football. But when the game needed to be won against North Melbourne and against Carlton, they finished off like a good team. And we think about them being out of form. They've won four of their last five. It's just the reality of who they've played against. And they wouldn't have beaten a lot of teams based on that form, but they had a good draw and they've profited from it.
Yeah, and it's probably a conversation we've had a lot here is I think when they actually started to focus a little bit on their attack, they actually defended better. I know all we hear from coaches and you know, the footy speak is, oh, we've got to defend hard, and things like that. But Nathan Buckley at halftime said, we've got to be a bit braver, but also start looking for it with their ball use. And what they did was, I noticed a lot, they didn't sit as far back. So when Carlton brings up the likes of Gibbons to a stoppage as a high half forward, as you notice a lot, that half forward comes up to the stoppage. Early in the game, Collingwood would sit that defender a little bit deeper, which almost encouraged everyone to sit deeper. And this has been, I think, for me, the shift in Collingwood with, you know, call it their form slump mid part of the year. They sit too deep across half back. Their mids then come back to half back. So when they do rebound it, they still have a very good defensive side, but they got nothing on the way out. So what they did is they brought Crisp and Maynard up really high, which they call contest coverage. So a pitcher, a throw in, where the wing normally sits, sweeper, sitting about 4 metres back inside, they brought the defender up. So that was Crisp or Maynard, which actually encouraged the Collingwood midfielders going, well, I've got the extra cover there. I can go forward at the stoppage. So Elliott, Pendlebury, these sort of guys, Dacos. So if we get it, I've got plenty of cover. But also if they turned it over, they're in a really good pattern to start running, or they get a really good space to start running to start that transition out. So the second half, Crisp, Maynard, Quainer ended up with 20 touches. Crisp ended up with 25. Maynard ended up with 18. They were all relatively quiet to half time, but they had huge amounts of possession in the second half. And that brings Dacos into the game because, you know, these guys are actually forcing Dacos to win the ball forward to centre. So it's that overlap knock-on effect. So it was actually attacking and wanting to attack a bit more and be a bit more creative actually helped them defend better because it got them all up higher on the ground in that territory game.
They got use the width of the Gabba much better than the Blues did too, particularly in the second half. Their wingers and their higher forwards on the transition, Jim, they're always on the open side, and Carlton just let it happen way too often. And I think, back to your initial point, Whitey, they're just not ready, the Blues. I'm just not sure they're fully believing that they're good enough come the moment. And 4 points in the second half they kicked yesterday. They post kicked 5 goals, 6. It was a panting in the end. The way that Collingwood got really good looks going inside forward 50 because they opened the ground up, whereas Carlton played safe and narrow and short and tried to find ways through the numbers. Collingwood went around them with width and speed, and I thought it was that was the difference in the end.
And there's obviously always two ways you can look at a game. It's statistically and it's a moment-based game. There's two parts to it. And in Carlton's case yesterday, Rammer, it was a moment-based situation for them where it was this hard hands to a mark that was dropped at 45 metres out. It was the wrong option when they had other options they could have gone to. My view is that the key word in all of that is composure under pressure. It's composure. And they just didn't have it. And Collingwood just found a way in the second half to have that composure.
I don't understand the Magpies there with it. They're better than finding a way. They're a good team.
They've played experienced football. No, I don't mean
football.
Finding a way. Well, good teams find a way. That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying that they were necessarily searching for it, that they had that experience of knowing how to win because they've won a lot of games over the last few years. So that it sort of comes, that emerges under pressure, doesn't it? The good players lift and the better teams win, often in a close game in that situation.
So you can be... you can have the best systems, the best structure, the best whatever you like. But if you can't execute the basics in pressure moments, it all goes out the door. All goes out the door. So that doesn't really matter. But what I want to ask the three of you guys, Carlton will get some players back, obviously, next season. You know, Curnow will come back, who's a really important player to them. But if you're sitting there as Carlton's list manager right at the moment, what do you think is the one area of the ground they need to continue to focus on to improve? Because they look like they're going to be a good team.
Yeah.
Ooh, good question.
Yeah. Well, that is a good question.
I'd like another inside mid. I just think they hate hearing it, but it's still a little bit crips or bust inside. Because they all... The knock-on effect he has for other players. When he started to roll a little bit and get his hands on the footy, others float off the back. I think Setterfield started the game pretty well inside. But I'm still not sure he's the long-term future as an inside mid. I think he's played his better footy out on the wing. That's for me. I think they've got enough options forward and back.
They're, give me Zach Williams.
Egan.
As a half Zach back. Williams.
Yep, isn't running and using halfback. That's what I want.
I think they need... Yeah, sorry, Jimmy. I think they need midfielders. Mark Murphy's coming towards the end. Ed Curnow's in the sort of the back end of his career. A lot of those early draft picks that they've had where they've used for midfielders, they haven't quite come on. You know, Paddy Dow's an example of that. Liam Stocker, I know he's in his second year, but they've targeted... They needed to thicken that midfield, but those players haven't necessarily developed because Paddy Cripps needs help, but they also need some outside run in the midfield as well, I think.
Yeah, I reckon if they can get Martin up and running to play a little bit more midfield minutes going 50-50 split, half, because half-half, you know, he plays half the time, half. Half-half, because 30% of their scoring chains go through him. So it just shows how dangerous he is in those attacking chains. And it provides that balance, I guess. If you've got Cripps, Martin and another, you've got a good little mix.
It's in the US Open markets. It kicks off tomorrow at 1 a.m, I think. It sort of kicks off our time tomorrow morning, early tomorrow morning. And Darren Cale will be watching it all unfold. And he's been good enough to join us on the Breakfast Club this morning. Darren, good morning.
Good morning, boys. I was actually just listening to see if there were any good tips for the horses over there. You had a few good ones, it sounds like.
A bit happening, yes. We're starting to build into a very nice spring carnival. No one there, of course, Darren, but there's some good horses running around.
I've got one, actually. It's called Evening Glory. Our Davis Cup boys for the last 15 or 20 years have always invested in the horse. So with Rusty, Late Stewart, and a bunch of other of the Davis Cup boys, we've got a horse called Evening Glory. So it's had a couple of small wins, but I love it. It's fantastic.
Right, Evening Glory. It's in my black book. I'll be looking it up throughout the morning and making sure I'm aware of what's going on. Nice work. Now, how's things there at the US Open, the Flushing Meadows? Because we're in a very different world, as we know at the moment, with everything, but certainly in the world of sport. And there's a developing story with one of the players, one of the men's players, testing positive to the coronavirus. What can you tell us in the latest?
Yeah, so Benoit Paire, the Frenchman, has tested positive, I think, in the last 24 to 48 hours. So he's been withdrawn from the tournament. His place in the draw was taken by Marcelo Grenouillet, a Spanish player. And he's the first one of, I think they've done about 7,000 tests since they've been here on site. A lot of the players got in about a week before the bubble started, which was before the Western and Southern Open, which was played on site here. It's normally the Cincinnati tournament. And so they've had a huge amount of players, both for singles and doubles, on site in this bubble, getting tested every 4 days. They've got three different tiers of testing. Tier one for all the players, for all the coaches and the players and the entourage. It's a player plus three that you can bring to the tournament. So they're in tier one. All the commentators are actually in tier one as well, because we have close access to the players. We have to interview the guys, so we have to kind of get in their space a little bit. So we have to adhere to the tier one protocols, which is getting tested every 4 days. And then you've got tier two and tier three, which is all the people walking around at ESPN that are basically putting this show together, and a bunch of the USTA staff. So it's, what they've done here has been remarkable. I've got nothing but positive things to say about the USTA. They didn't have to run this event. I'm not sure if they're making money out of it, or they are, but if they are making any money, it's not very much. Certainly for the hassle they've gone to make this happen, it's been for the players, and they've done a remarkable job. Remembering also, you've got AFL teams in a bubble back there in Australia, but you're only dealing with Australians, you're only dealing with people flying into state. We've got something like 42 countries represented in the men's draw alone. So dealing with getting players in from other countries into New York. And as you know, there's a bunch of restrictions at the moment with people flying into New York. So it's been incredibly difficult for them. And to have only one positive test, I think that's a testament to how well the USTA has done.
So you were watching a lot of this, Darren, unfold from Australia and the build-up to it all. Now you're over inside it. You've kind of touched on my question about being sort of surprised and impressed by it all. What's the general feeling of everybody else? Do people feel safe? Do people feel like, yes, this tournament should be going ahead? Because there's been a big, big controversy around this whole US Open.
I think the controversy lies in America at the moment. What it's like in the US, it's so political over here. You've got Trump and Biden on TV every night basically slamming each other. If you mention anything about wearing a mask or not wearing a mask, you either alienate 50% of the country or 50% of the country jumps on the back of you and says, well done. It's an amazing place to be at the moment. I actually came over a little bit early because I put my son into college over here. He was born in Australia but spent the first 15 or 16 years of his life here in the US, and went back to Australia for a few years, but always wanted to come back to college here in the US. So we put him into college, Furman University in South Carolina. South Carolina is actually one of the hotspots in America at the moment, that the coronavirus is kind of out of control. But he's in a controlled environment as well, where it's 3,000 students all on campus there in the States. But honestly, it's a bit of a mess. I must say, the US at the moment is a bit of a mess for many, many reasons. And the fact that we're kind of blocked away from it here at the US Open, that's what makes everybody feel safe and content that everything's well controlled off. But if we didn't have these protocols, if it was loose, like the country is loose, flying into Australia at the moment, you've got to do 2 weeks of isolation. You've got to pay for your hotel. You've got security guards that basically bring your food, you know, all that sort of stuff. And there's no exemptions. You can't get away with it. When my son and I flew across here to the US, we went through the customs. Hey, how's it going? How long have you been away? Well, we've been away about 4 or 5 months. Well, welcome back. Be safe. Nothing about isolating for 2 weeks. Nothing really about precautions. It's completely different the way they treat the coronavirus to what the way we treat it in Australia. And I don't have to tell you guys, but the way you guys are treating it in Melbourne, it's just it's much better in Australia than it is to be in the US, for sure.
So, Darren, with such little tennis being played over recent times, obviously, how do we get a form line on the men and women? What are you expecting over the next couple of weeks?
Well, the women have played a few small tournaments. They played one in Prague. I think there was one in Palermo as well, but they were on clay. So a few of the players got a bunch of opportunities to play some matches. The opportunity for the women here is enormous, and I don't think there's any clear one favourite, because I think 6 or 7 of the top 10 are actually not here. And the young lady that I coach, Simona Halep, decided not to come over here. More of a health issue than anything else. So there are plenty of opportunities. I know Serena Williams is still the betting favourite at the moment, but what we saw from her last week wasn't great, and she can be a little vulnerable at the moment. And the biggest thing that she's struggling with is she's playing well in patches, but she's just having problems putting matches away, where the old Serena would just crush you. She'd get you into a winning position and put the foot on the throat. That's just not happening at the moment. She's letting players of lesser quality back into matches they have no business being in. But she's dropped a little bit of confidence, and with that, most of the players now are walking onto the court thinking to themselves, this is a great opportunity. Whereas once upon a time playing Serena, you were thinking about winning games. You weren't thinking about actually winning matches. So that's kind of the whole way through the women's tour. You know, players like Kerber at the moment, who's ranked about 30 or 40 in the world, she's a dark horse and a great opportunity. Pliskova is probably the best player ever to win a Grand Slam. She's the number one seed here. If she plays well, she's going to be tough to beat. But I could say that about 20 of the women. I think it's going to be a really fascinating draw from that point of view because we don't have much to go on, but there is so much depth in the women's game and so many good players here that anybody that gets hot can certainly win it. On the men's side, you can't look past Novak. Even the way he played here to win the Western and Southern Open, it was remarkable that he wasn't playing at his best. He hasn't lost a match for 2020. Got himself in trouble a couple of times with a little bit stick in the guts on the semi-finals. It looked like he got the trainer on a few times and tablets to try to get through it. When push came to shove and defeat was staring him in the eyes, he said, no way. He just digs in and he uses his legs and he makes people put them away. And he's so tough to do when you're playing him. So he's going to go in here as the raging favourite. The courts are playing a little bit quicker. They've changed the surface at the US Open, so all of the big servers and the big hitters are having some good results already. John Isner, Ivo Karlovic will be tough. And you've got a other bunch of Kevin Anderson's playing Zverev in the first round. That's going to be one of the best first rounds. So look for a lot of the big hitters to do well, but you certainly can't go past Novak.
Melbourne Storm are in it up to their eyeballs in the NRL in season 2020. They had a big win over the Sea Eagles on the weekend, 30-6, if you don't mind. 6-1. It was an absolute clinic, and Christian Welch was a big part of the campaign. He joins us, the prop from the Storm. Good morning, Christian.
Morning, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Good on you, buddy. Great to have you on the program, and what a performance. A clinic pretty much from start to finish, all the way through. Tries evenly spread. A great performance from your teammates and your boys.
Yeah, it was really pleasing. You know, after last week's loss against Parramatta, it was really nice to turn it around and have a really good win against a really tough side. So we knew Manly were going to be really desperate. They had to basically win that game to keep their finals hopes alive, and they're a pretty quality side. So it also helped having a few big ins with a big Jesse, Munster, Hughesy and Cameron Smith all come back and joined us. So that gave us a lot of confidence, and yeah, we played pretty well.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Obviously, last week's loss, it was predicted. You're outsiders with the injuries, and the players that weren't out there was always going to make it difficult against the Eels. But did it take any confidence away, or was it just a matter of just trying to get through and build back up to this game this weekend?
No, not at all, mate. To be honest, we lost that game last week, but we come away with a fair bit of confidence. We're really happy with our effort, our aggression, our urgency in the game, and you know, a couple of calls and a couple of things go our way. Who knows how that result goes? And we're really pleased, and especially with the amount of guys out, the guys that come in and have been doing a job for us. You know, the guys who have been on debut. We had another debutant last night, Isaac Lumi. He played fantastic, so it's been really great to give these guys a go because there's no reserve grade. That's all been cancelled, and these guys have just been training their ass off. So it's really nice to give them a reward, and especially in a winning team.
And a couple of more injuries, though, yesterday.
Yes.
An ACL injury and a calf injury. Can you give us an update on those, Christian?
Yeah, having done two ACLs myself, I feel really feel for Marion. He's been having a great year. He just had a comeback, so real sorry for him. It's such a long layoff and long recovery, so I really feel for him. And Big Nelson, I think he'll probably miss a week or two. Got a couple out, but I think that's just the year it's been, to be honest, mate. There's no buys. It's all been all of the gate kind of stuff. So, yeah, I think every side's had plenty of injuries. So, we've just got to deal with it and use the depth in our squad.
So the run-in, yeah, so you talk about that depth. So the run-in to the final series, is it about refreshing the group or is it about continuing the momentum? Because obviously you've had some injuries, you've got some injuries. What do you think the plan will be from Craig?
Yeah, I think there's a fine balance there. I think you all want to be heading into finals with a lot of momentum, but then also, you know, understanding we're basically gone 20 games straight without a bye. And being based up at Sunny Coast, we're up and back in a day on planes, getting back at 3, 2-3 a.m. After game, so it does take its toll on the body. So I'm sure there might be a little bit of a rotation, but I don't think Craig likes to rest too many of the boys. So yeah, we'll be working hard for the remainder of the season and hopefully for a long final series ahead.
I want to ask you about that. I mean, you guys are away from home. You're doing a lot of travelling and it's a grueling schedule, but you keep stepping up to the mark. I mean, how are you doing it?
Yeah, look, I think we're just getting on with it, to be honest. And I think a bit of perspective on, you know, what our issues are compared to a lot of other Australians, you know, everyday Australians. I know the Victorians, you know, have been through two lockdowns, you know, that mentally that's taking its toll, and economically jobs and unemployment's rising. And, you know, mate, it's really tough, you know, compared to what we've got to go through. We're up in sunny Coast at a resort, still being able to do our job, still being able to play rugby league. So I think we're all pretty grateful that the competition's been able to go on. So, yeah, we're all mindful of that. It is a bit weird here at the resort, to be honest. There's no general public, so it's the Melbourne Storm, it's the Essendon, Collingwood and the Demons. So it's all a bit of a real sporting hub at the moment down at the restaurant and the lounge. And I think every team actually won on the weekend, so it'll be hopefully brought a few smiles to all our Victorian fans, whether they're AFL fans or Storm fans, over the weekend.
Yes, absolutely. And you've got the Rabbitohs on Friday night, which is going to be another great tussle, so it'll keep you in check. But before we let you go, Christian, I want to raise something that Craig Bellamy was speaking across the weekend about players inside the hubs and how everyone's coping. He's put you in the pest category. Are you happy about that?
Yeah, I saw this. It was a desperate reach from the old coach. I'm telling you, we've got a goose of the week, a little thing we've been doing each week, and you have to wear the old Steen headgear at all meals throughout the week, breakfast, lunch, dinner. And he got stitched up last week because of his own, you know, goose actions, and now he's just trying to drag people down with him. So it's a desperate ploy from a desperate man, and don't read into it, people. I'm one of the good guys in the rugby league.
That was the best of the Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.